I'm Christopher Lydon in the post-game booth with the healthcare analyst James Marone, who said all along, this is a peculiarly personal story, this business of politics and medicine and presidents, starting with Franklin Roosevelt's polio and Dwight Eisenhower's heart crises and JFK's many brushes with death. And then their adventures in healthcare policy become the narrative of their terms in office. This is open source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. This one with the political scientist at Brown who wrote The Heart of Power about health and politics in the Oval Office last year and has become a favorite commentator on this game, high above courtside. Jim Marone, in the New York Times 2 weeks ago, you were quoted saying the Obama White House had lost its own narrative in the healthcare fight before everything turned around last weekend. What happened?
It's a fascinating story, isn't it, Chris? It's great to be here, by the way.
Thank you.
This is a story of a healthcare a crusade, you'd have to say, on Obama's part. Look, if you are going to take one issue, the economy in shambles, Obama takes over, if you're going to take one issue to make the issue, is it really going to be healthcare? Apparently, there was a meeting at the White House a few weeks into the administration where all the economists told Barack Obama, listen, healthcare is too complicated. It's one thing piled too high on the plate. And Obama himself said, no, if I'm going to win this, it has to be now. I want to win it. Obama has healthcare in his gut. It's lodged deep in his soul. And I think it is.
And the mother story.
I think the mother story really, really touched him. It touched him in some deep way. That last weekend of the campaign where he stood before his supporters and wept. Openly, that dangerous thing to do in American politics, wept openly about the death of his grandmother and recalled in his own book about his mother's death, fighting insurance companies over cancer. These personal episodes obviously touched him, so he decided this would be his great crusade. And then, Chris, the most bizarre thing, Obama throws his presidency, really, on the line over an issue that has beaten everyone, Roosevelt, Truman, Kennedy, Nixon, Carter, Clinton. It's got some pretty good presidents there. Beaten them all, and Obama goes for it and then disappears. He hands it to Pelosi and Reid and goes AWOL on this issue that he's insisted on pursuing. He seems to have done a good job twisting elbows in Congress, but in the summer, 3-4 months into the debate, the Tea Party explodes on the scene with a simple narrative. This bill is a killer. It'll kill your granny. Wonderful symbolic resonance. What a great narrative. Hats off to the Tea Party people. It says government is scary. And it resonated. You walk into a liquor store in New Hampshire and ask about health care, and they'll tell you, I don't want any bureaucratic panel in Washington deciding on my health. And where was the counter-narrative? Where was the dying mother? Gone. So Obama leaves the field, and by the end of the summer, even the Republicans who had reached tentatively across the aisle, maybe the Charles Grassleys, were repeating, throw granny off the train. I'd worry about your grandmother if this goes through. The Democrats have only their votes. They've lost their story. And with Massachusetts, they lose their votes as well. By all accounts, everybody says now this thing is dead. We've lost the narrative. Now we've lost the votes. And Obama, after this great defeat, after he can no longer win the votes, and let's recall where we were. The House has passed it. The Senate has passed, but different bills. It goes to negotiations. They are, by all accounts, about 24 hours from agreeing on the bills. It will then go back to the Senate, go back to the House. They'll vote one bill through, triumph for the Democrats. They may have lost the narrative, but they still had the votes. At that moment, Massachusetts loses the 60th Democratic vote on a campaign, Scott Brown's campaign, that says, we're going to stop health reform. It is on the floor. And now, at what would be the 11th hour and 48th minute, Obama finally finds his voice. Where were you, Barack? He now comes forward. And what the Congress tells him is, we can't do this without your moving the public opinion needle. And Obama goes into full court JFK eloquence mode. He's suddenly speaking every day, day in and day out. And in it, he gives us a lesson about the bully pulpit. This was a use of the bully pulpit like few others in American history.
But what was it he said that moved the needle, in your view?
Every good narrative has a problem, a solution, and a villain. He had a problem. And the problem was given to him wrapped up in a golden bow when the Blue Cross Anthem in California had a 39% rate increase. Was it 39, 40%? David Axelrod sees that in a blog and goes running into the Oval Office and goes, here's the hook. Obama's got his problem, a 40% increase in 1 year. He's got a solution. I've got a bill before Congress. And he's got a villain, the health insurance industry, whom he knows will not fight back because they, dirty rotten secret, Chris, they want this bill. So there's his narrative now. And then he finds a woman who has had a pre-existing condition, diabetes. And he holds her up. Here's a woman who can't get health care. And in the process of the discussion, it turns out she has further illnesses. And suddenly Obama is in front of cheering crowds with his arm around sick people, saying these people are sick and the insurance company are screwing them. So there's a narrative that gives Congress coverage. All of a sudden, the members who are like, oh, no, we're not going anywhere near this, all of a sudden, they've got some cover. There's a counter story. Does it persuade everyone? No, of course not. But now there are two equal stories. One, the government is a villain and will kill your granny. Two, just as plausible, the insurance companies are profit-seeking, greedy maggots, and they will take your insurance and swipe it away from you if you have the bad luck to get sick.
Or that a kid born with asthma will never get treated.
Or that a kid born with asthma will die. You know, get it right out there. So now we've got two narratives dueling. Now we got a fight. Now we got a chance. And it's really Barack Obama's story. I mean, I think when historians go back and tell this, they'll think, my God, near-death experience. And he rallies.
Consider the one flight on Air Force One with Dennis Kucinich. That fascinated me because Dennis Kucinich basically voiced objections that resonated with me. This thing was designed by the insurance companies. We were all going to be – they'd killed the public option. This was an insurance company bill. Obama put him on the plane, talked to them for an hour, and he came off saying, no, the Obama presidency is the issue. The bill isn't that good, but we cannot let the Republicans trash a good man in this critical office at this moment. It became intensely personal. In effect, Dennis, you've got to vote it because you, who lusted for the presidency yourself, can see that the whole office is in jeopardy.
Isn't that interesting? I mean, you've put it exactly right, Chris. First, it's about a bill, a flawed bill. If you're anywhere left of, well, dead center, maybe right of dead center, you think, good God, this bill was a lot better before it went through all its permutations. Peak and pork. The peak of Joe Lieberman, single-handedly killing the Medicare buy-in, the pork of Ben Nelson and others. This bill was freighted with all kinds of problems. And so members of the left, and I don't mean the far left, I don't even mean the Dennis Kucinich left, moderate lefties think, you know, this is not a great bill. But look at what it comes down to. Chris, I can't think of another example in presidential history where it came down to this. If Obama loses this, he's Jimmy Carter. He's dead. Right. Imagine Obama loses this and he goes to a congressman for anything else. They're going to laugh at him. Get out of here. I'm not going to follow you again. If he wins it, he's suddenly bigger than life. And it's all on one vote on one Sunday afternoon. There's lots of examples, but the Spanish caucus comes up, the Latino caucus, and they say, we want immigration reform. Where's immigration reform? And Obama can look him in the eye and say, you vote against this. We're getting nothing. I'm dead. So there's Kucinich on Air Force One, and apparently Obama said two things. You really want to send this Democratic presidency down the tubes? It's in your power. And then he said, Dennis, you've got a safe district. You have to vote for this. There's a lot of other people who are in real danger of going down. We got to release them. You got to protect not only my presidency, but as much of the Democratic majority as you can. And by the end of the flight, Kucinich had changed his mind in a way that dominated the news cycle for a full 24 hours. That was huge. But look at how it's done. I mean, here's a president who's willing to take Air Force One for one congressman and roll it out and gets a full 24-hour news cycle for it. He really played the presidency like he knew what he was doing. Mm. You know, hello, Barack, where have you been? But boy, it does seem that Obama tends to get lulled into a sense of complacency. We saw this in the New Hampshire primary, where he just was sort of playing out the string. He was going to win the office, and Hillary knocked him off. Remember how sleepy he looked at the last debate? You're likable. You're perfectly likable, Hillary, he said.
You're likable enough.
Likable enough. That's the line. And here he was again in his presidency, sort of coasting along. But boy, show him a political near-death experience, and that guy rallies.
But what if the near-death was exaggerated, maybe even created on cable television?
That's the great story here is its narrative, counter-narrative, counter-counter-narrative. In the case of the death of the presidency, I think that's true. I think losing this after a year's fight.
But was he in danger? Was he in that grave danger of losing it, do you think, in retrospect?
Of losing the vote? I think, yes, he was. I think those votes did not come easily. And no one ever went broke voting against health insurance to rewrite the P.T. Barnum quote. This thing has fallen by the wayside so many times in American history. I think the Democrats, as a party, call them feckless, call them lacking certain parts of the anatomy that Republicans seem to have, but they really seem to have been so stunned by the loss of Massachusetts that they really had to make a calculation. And that is, if I run against Obama and the Democrats in Congress, I can save my seat, despite the fact that this is something Democrats have been fighting for since 1938. But I'm really impressed as I talk to the people on the Washington inside how that bombshell really shook the Democrats up. They are a party that's been really in the minority since 1978. And minority thinking has gotten into their souls and made them timid, I think. So even though they had this vast majority, the sort of timidity of being beaten so many times, of losing the landslides to Nixon and Reagan and Bush and Bush, I think this has really gotten into their spirit. So yes, I think that I think that's an accurate perception.
But Jim Marone, a whole new comprehensive narrative is being laid out even as we speak about the nature of the Republican Party, the value of partisanship, Barack the fighter, the 2010 election cycle, the future of absolutely everything. What do you believe? What's your new narrative?
What's most interesting, what everybody has to remember, is there's a long-term historical story which people at places like Brown are going to go back and investigate 10 years from now. And that will be robust. We'll have lots of information. We'll know what happened to this reform. But that's the long term.
Let's hear it. I mean, I don't
– But let's start with the short term, which is really what you're talking about. Like all politics, this is a narrative to be made, to be constructed. So in the short term – nothing's going to happen. A few of this reform pieces will go into place, but it will be years before we know how this reform actually plays out. And in the meantime, there'll be narrative and counter-narrative. And each side will try to construct a political story. Mm. And the real question is, what's your political story? The great presidents, the Roosevelts, the Reagans, the Jacksons, the Washingtons – what they do, they don't pass programs. It's not. Reagan didn't pass much. Washington didn't pass anything. What they do is they construct a story that Americans come to believe. Roosevelt, these dark times will be worth all they cost us if they teach us that our true purpose is to minister to our fellow man. A social gospel story. We're all in this together. That was a story that Obama picked up in the campaign. Big narrative. Ronald Reagan, no. Go for it. We're all individualists. Markets are good. Government's the problem. The Reagan narrative – Reagan is a great president in my view because he gave America a narrative. What Barack Obama has never done – And the narrative is individualism is good, and you don't worry about community. You worry about each individual. That's what made America great. I want to be a president of a country where a young person can still become a millionaire, says Reagan. Obama never took on that great narrative. He did in the campaign, the debate with Joe the Plumber. And things are better when we spread the wealth around. He didn't touch it as president. And now he has a chance through legislation. We're going to worry about that 31, 33 million people without health insurance. Will he tell his narrative, or will he go back to playing small ball again? Will the Tea Partiers tell their narrative? It's not just, Chris, about this program. What we've really done, and we do this often with healthcare, is entered into a conversation, screaming, yelling, cheating, lying, about the nature of America. Are we a community in which we watch out for one another? Or is that nonsense, big government, lefty stuff? Are we in the era of Barack Obama? Or are we still in the era of Ronald Reagan? And it's up for grabs, in my view.
That's so fascinating. I've been calling it the age of Obama since Inauguration Day. And yet, the curtain hasn't risen. We haven't seen a kind of revisionist post-George Bush, post-Iraq, the definition of the last best hope of Earth. What are we? What is our role in the world? How do we? What kind of family are we at home? To me, the narrative is empire, the excesses of empire, overextension in military adventures, starvation of the culture and the community back home. He hasn't quite stuck his head into that question yet. But I wonder if you were Barack Obama. Or reading him as you do, Jim, pull the narrative out that you think is waiting to be told.
Yes, that's a great question. And you raise the question of empire. And here's a place, just as a sidebar, where Obama's hopeful supporters were naive. A man doesn't come along and take what is genuinely an empire, and let's be blunt, a declining empire, and say, okay, we're not going to be empire anymore. You don't take 750 military installations and a football with the codes to communicate with the launch centers always 10 feet away from you. You don't take all that. There's a huge military apparatus and wave it away no matter how effective you are. Eisenhower couldn't do it, and no one has done it since. So here's Barack Obama in an era of individualism and declining empire. So what does he do? I had an inaugural address all queued up in my head.
Let's hear it.
And the inaugural address went, I admire Ronald Reagan. I think he was a very impressive president, as I said in the campaign. But now we turn the page on the Reagan era. I'm with Martin Luther King. I am my brother's keeper, inevitably, because I'm my brother's brother. That we are now, as we've learned from the Wall Street meltdown, we now have to understand ourselves as a community. We've got to worry about each other, and that means fixing the legislative process. Now, that gives you a reason for bipartisanship. Obama never did that. I wept after his inaugural address, and I wept after his first State of the Union message, which could have been delivered by George Bush. There was all kinds of small ball in it. As the Republicans sat there, you couldn't hear most of this in the television, but they booed and they hissed and they catcalled. "You lie," in a different speech, was just one piece of booing that actually happened to be caught by the cameras. What Obama needs is a story now that says, look, here's why I believe in bipartisanship. He doesn't have to say we're a declining empire. We know it, but he can't say that. But he can say the era of Ronald Reagan is over. Mm. Reagan came in and said the era of Roosevelt is over. The era of civil rights is over. The era of help thy neighbor is over. What Barack has to do is turn the page on that. And until he does, this piece of legislation becomes a kind of crazy anomaly that somehow made it through because he had the vote and made pretty speeches. He needs to explain his vision of America. And what's remarkable, Chris, is he did such a marvelous job in the campaign doing that, and yet not once has he stood up and done it during his presidency. Now that he's awoken, maybe, and now that he's got this legislative victory, whatever you think of the actual law, this improbable victory, now is his chance to tell a really big narrative about what America means. That would really make him, if it sticks, that would really make him an outstanding president in the pantheon along with Ronald Reagan.
It really would, and you sense an awful lot of people, not just the ones who voted for him, certainly people around the world are waiting for him to pick up that narrative of, I'm the child of a refugee from empire. My father left Kenya for America to pursue that transnational dream that is, you know, this is not the dominant power in the world. It is the every power of the world. It is the whole human family, but he is the vessel of a new century and a new kind of transnational moment at a time when the species and the whole habitat are in palpable danger, blah, blah, blah.
Yes.
I mean, that would be my second inaugural, too.
Yes. And where do you begin? I mean, you can begin in foreign policy, as you're suggesting, not in terms of armies and doubling down in Afghanistan, but in remembering the hope that this country at its best offers every immigrant. Oh, immigrant! Immigration! Now, there's an issue to tackle, not okay, here's a policy wonk thing. We got to do something with 38 million people. But I embody the dream that is America.
Yeah, exactly.
That creates a kind of logic. Where else could you go with it? You could say, okay, folks, we've just had a seminar in the workings of Congress. And you know what? We're a great power. We can't have a legislature that's this broken. Let's create a blue panel commission to suggest a series of reforms for Congress. Is it going to win next year? No. But surely this legislative body is not 21st century ready. The Constitution sets up a legislature with checks and balances, but my God, we've added it to an absurd degree. There's no filibuster in the Constitution. That came in 1808 to save slavery, just as the international slave trade was being outlawed. So there's something else he can do. He can stand up, explain what America means to the world, immigration reform. He can stand up and say, our system is broken. Let's start fixing it. Instead of this dreamy bipartisanship, hey, that doesn't work. Let's think about where the problem lies. Let's go deeper when we start talking about bipartisanship and get a commission of the great graybeards from both left and right, from both Republicans and Democrats, and say, what do you propose for Congress so we don't have this endless stalemate? And just those things alone, wrapped in this, here's my image of America, the son of a Kenyan who saw hope in this country. You know, that's the other thing about Ronald Reagan, Chris, that he didn't just say government bad. He had a dreamy, gauzy, marvelous quality about the wonder of America.
Yeah.
No one's picked this up, certainly not Bush, and even Clinton, for all his rhetorical magic, no one's picked it up like Obama has. In that sense, he is Reagan-esque. If you've got a powerful core that you believe in no matter what, and Reagan did have that, you can go in all kinds of directions that your base doesn't expect because the core is so strong. Reagan's core, he loved this country. Boy, you read his biography, and everything reminds him of what a great country it is. It's almost like a 9-year-old. He hears a choir in Washington, D.C., and he says, only in America. Well, nonsense. There are choirs all over the world. But to him, it's America. Barack Obama has that core. I'm the son of an immigrant. I'm only in America. Even the French will agree with that. Their intelligentsia are going around shaking their heads saying, it was so much fun to feel superior to you during the Bush years. And now you've done this. We can't do that. We suddenly have a crisis of confidence. This is a remarkable thing he's got at his core. I think this healthcare legislation gives him a platform to get up and tell a story about America. And damn it, I hope he doesn't blow it again and get back into small ball and compromise. Sure, compromise on the legislation, but find your rhetorical voice and tell us a story about America.
The dream from his father, extended.
Exactly.
Jim, let's talk about unintended consequences in this healthcare bill. Unintended consequences are so often decisive. The wisdom today seems to be that nobody really knows how this rather basic new framework of universal care is going to work out or what it's going to cost. I'm still thinking of the piece that Atul Gawande wrote in The New Yorker in which he said, remember what happened to agriculture in the 20th century, how cost and the share of spending in America came radically down for what we pay for our food. He said there could be a model there in the way agricultural policy experimented and came up with new methods at the local level. There could be a model for a fundamental transformation in healthcare. What do you think is going to play out of this legislation, which, as people finally discovered at the end, was not radical legislation. It was basically Mitt Romney, Massachusetts, healthcare spread around the country. But in the details, it's going to surprise us. How do you think?
Yeah, a comment quickly, just a footnote about Mitt Romney. Democratic health legislation usually chases the last Republican bill. Richard Nixon tries to pass national health insurance. He breaks with the old Social Security tradition, which is basically single payer, and says, no, we're going to have employers stay in pay place and try to use competition. It gets picked up by Democrats. The Nixon bill inspires Carter. Clinton is essentially the Nixon bill. What do the Republicans do when Clinton floats his bill? Our own Rhode Island's John Chafee with Robert Dole, the Senate minority leader at the time, float their bill. What's in it? An individual mandate and a tax break. This is now known as Obamacare. The Democrats pick up the Republican bills. Now, back in 1993, Clinton light. The Democrats didn't even want to consider the Chafee Dole bill or the Dole Chafee bill. And now they've got the Dole Chafee bill. So, as you say, it's not nearly as big or radical or dramatic as people think. A couple of things are going to come out of it, I believe. First, big risk for the Democrats. They're now overselling the bill, and everything – and since it doesn't fix our healthcare problems, every time someone encounters a problem with the healthcare system, it's going to be the Democrats' fault. This is going to help a lot, I think, on the margins. People will be able to buy private insurance. The great hidden thing in this bill is a vast subsidy to help middle-class people buy private insurance. Step one, then. I have a problem. I now blame the government. But what does that mean? Here's a real unforeseen consequence, except by, amazingly enough, those liars in the Tea Party. I think they got this right. What's the second step? The government now gets screamed at every time something goes wrong. Mm. That's likely to lead to further government intervention. So if you're a liberal, hang on. This could be a pretty wild ride. So just give you an example. People can't afford insurance because the costs are going up too high, because the cost controls in this bill are trivial. They could have been much larger, but the moderates cut them out. What are you going to do? The path of least resistance is going to be to raise the tax subsidy, which you're giving the middle class to help them buy private insurance. Tax cuts. Republicans can live with that. In fact, I predict if the Republicans take over Congress, they'll be all over that. Democrats can live with that. Insurance companies will love that. So watch additional payments going in this really easy form. And then there'll be all kinds of pressures on Congress, on the president, on the administration to really take cost control seriously, because now they're responsible either directly or really indirectly for the most part, for 32 million more people. So the incentives are in place for real health insurance reform. This is what I would call, to be honest about it, slouching to national health insurance. Mm. We've got a big foot in the door. But a huge irony, unforeseen consequence, the Tea Partiers are right in the sense that it's hard to see how this won't lead to more government action. But hey, I'm a lefty. I think that's a good thing. I'll tell you what. You look around the world. I've been going around giving lectures. And everywhere I go, people shake their heads and say, our health system works. Canada, Australia, Denmark, Norway, England, Austria, for crying out loud.
Cuba, please.
Cuba. Well, I don't want to go way left. I don't want to go to countries that seem vaguely like us. They look at us and they say, "What? This works." Hey, if you look around the world, they've all – back up a second. OECD average cost increase percent of GDP last 8 years, zero. OECD is tamed inflation. Oh, they all complain and they have problems. Of course, every nation has a problem, but they've tamed it. So if you look around the world, you see, you know, most people kind of like their healthcare systems. Now, they don't have to support an empire. They don't have to support 750 military installations around the world, but they like their healthcare systems. And I think we're in a path now down a slope that could actually get us to a rather sensible healthcare system, because now I think government really is on the line. So Democrat or Republican, I see paths to a really quite sensible health insurance system. Will we do it? Well, you've probably heard the Winston Churchill quote 1,000 times on this show. Count on Americans to do the right thing after they've exhausted every other possibility. I think we may be heading, as an unforeseen consequence, to a more sensible healthcare system. There's an unforeseen consequence you weren't expecting, Chris.
In the long run, what will we say was the popular will here? I mean, there was so much talk about people hate this plan, it's being forced down their throat, trickery, blah, 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 or that people wanted something much more Canadian, much more public option, much more socialistic. In the end, what did people want, Jim Marrone?
If this were a call-in show, we'd have some people calling in saying, the public opinion polls show that people want a single payer. That's what they want. Why didn't Congress do it? And then the next call comes in and goes, Congress just rammed something through against the will of the people. And you think, okay, which is it? Where's public opinion?
You're the scientist of these things.
Well, the answer is clear. And moreover, the people voted for Barack Obama, who promised that even in a great financial crisis, he's going to get health reform. And then they voted for Scott Brown. They changed their mind? Here's the answer. Anybody who reads public opinion polls and takes them as fact in healthcare is a fool. Public opinion polls reflect the sort of the storm. People generally are fearful about their healthcare, even if they like their own. And the other poll that I think is pretty robust is that people with experience in healthcare in the United States, that is people who've been sick, generally rate the healthcare system lower in the United States than people in other nations rate theirs. Those, I think, are numbers you can rely on. But what polls reflect is the public discourse. When there's an outcry, people think, oh my God, I don't like this. The base doesn't. The Democratic base thinks we want single payer. The Republican base thinks we want markets. But the independents always exit when there's conflict. They don't vote in elections that are very dirty, and they don't like policies that have screaming involved in them. So healthcare always turns off the independents once it gets into the screaming phase.
Fascinating.
And healthcare always gets to a screaming phase. So you have to understand these polls as things reflecting, again, the narrative. People think, gee, I'm frightened about healthcare. My mother was in the hospital. That was a kind of tricky experience. I have a neighbor who lost health insurance. Yeah, let's reform it. The screaming begins, and everybody who's not already committed runs for the exits. Oh, my God, I want health reform, but not this. And if you're reading the polls, what you're going to do is have the same cycle every time. The people want health care, not this health care. Oh, my God, don't vote for that. It happens every single time health care comes up, and people are reflecting the disputes. What the American public is really responding to is a Congress, I think, more than anything else, that's busted. I think the world has had a year-long seminar on why America doesn't have health insurance. Why? One word answer, Congress. Check this out, Chris. 1948, Harry Truman runs this unbelievable campaign. No one thinks he can win. He wins, coming from behind. Famous headline, Dewey defeats Truman. You didn't have to actually stay up for the results. You knew Dewey was going to win. He didn't. Truman won. Single biggest issue, national health insurance. If we were playing by English or Canadian or Australian or German parliamentary rules, he won the election on national health insurance. We get national health insurance in 1949, what, 2-3 years after the Brits, and 11-12 years before the Canadians. We're as socialist as they are. We didn't get it. We didn't get it because Congress, when Truman submits his proposal, laughs and says, not in your lifetime, which turns out to be true. Clinton runs. Number two issue for the Clinton administration in 1992, health reform. If we were playing by Canadian or British or German or Australian rules, we get national health insurance. It's not the public not voting for it and Americans hating socialism. It's a legislative process designed by the founders to break the Democratic will, and one that has multiplied its checks and balances to now, I think, it's really, as many political scientists are writing, the broken branch of government. And I think the great unexpected lesson from health reform this time is this national seminar in, good God, do we really want a legislature that works like that? Shouldn't we be thinking about how to fix it?
This is the Larry Lessig and others' new campaign. Change the Constitution, even.
You know, it's interesting. You don't have to change the Constitution. I think you have to go back and look at the rules of Congress. I'll just give you one example. The first Congress sat down and included in it a rule that every legislature in the world includes, which is a way to have a motion to stop debate. A majority stops debate. In 1808, 10 years later, the Congress rewrote that law, rewrote the rules of process, and the Senate dropped the ability to stop debate. And between 1809 and the 19-teens, the Woodrow Wilson administration, there was no way to stop debate, period. Back in the sleepy 19th century, that was probably okay. We had a small government. We had no empire. And the private system worked pretty well with the government helping to construct an infrastructure. It didn't work so great during wars like the Civil War, but then presidents amassed enormous power because the Constitution gave them the power in that kind of emergency. Woodrow Wilson at the start, the second decade of the 20th century, decided, look, this is just not working, and he imposed a rule that said, okay, with 60 votes, you can break the filibuster. So the filibuster rules really only go back to the Woodrow Wilson administration. It's time to change that now. You don't need a constitutional amendment. You need to sit down with the rules of Congress and think through what works and what, frankly, no longer does.
I was thinking also, though, Jim, of all those underpopulated Western small states, the Wyomings of the world, that can beat the big cities, can beat New York, because they've each got two senators.
Yes, that's true. It's very unrepresentative. So here we have Al Gore winning an election by 500,000 votes, and yet everybody agrees if he lost Florida, he shouldn't be seated. A very anti-democratic kind of politics. And here we have a health debate where if you count up the people on the Senate Finance Committee who really are deciding how this thing is going to look, they represent 12% of the population. States like North Dakota, like Iowa. So here we have this very biased system of representation. So yes, if you want to take that on, I'm not sure I see, Chris, how we get to there just through the political minefield. So I'm starting smaller. But of course, that's a whole different conversation. One way to think about it is Americans have a choice. Do you care more about representing the will of the people or having a government that doesn't act very effectively, that basically it's a choice between democracy and your dread of government? And Americans have chosen, through their Constitution, the dread of government over their democracy. But it's a conversation worth us starting. Do we really want to make that choice? Dread of government, don't let government operate, over democracy. Here's a deal you can make if you're a lefty. You can make with your right-wing foes or not. Sit down with Newt Gingrich and say, Newt, here's a deal. When we're in power, we get to do what we promise the people. When you're in power, you get to do what you promise to the people. Then we have something called essentially genuine representative government. You get elected. You do what you promise the people you're going to do. We're going to put aside all those checks and balances that make elections kind of wild, dumb puppet shows about all kinds of extraneous issues and really make them about the kind of legislation we're going to pass. When I say that to some of my lefty friends, they say, oh, my God, you mean the right wing would get to pass their agenda too? And I say, yeah, it's called representative government, even democracy. We might try it some year.
Jim Marone, this is fascinating. Last question for me. I mean, you're talking about the healthcare victory as sort of the start of Obama II, Obama reborn, a new inauguration. Do the 2010 congressional elections have to confirm that or not?
You know, that's really interesting. Everybody's taking the ultimate test of this year of this legislation to be the midterm elections. So we get a referendum and we find out whether Barack's gamble pays off or not. Let me suggest a different historical test. In 1963, Kennedy's assassinated and Lyndon Johnson takes over, and he passes in quick succession the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, and Medicare. He passes the Civil Rights Act in 63, and in 64, before the election, he wins a landslide election. After that, he passes two other great, great pieces of legislation, Medicare and the Voting Rights Act. And what happens? He gets slaughtered in the next midterm. The Democrats in the South begin to turn Republican. If you use the midterm test, you'd go back and tell LBJ, good God, don't pass Medicare. It'll kill you. And for God's sake, bad enough you pass civil rights, don't pass the Voting Rights Act. Mm. That'll kill you too. You lose the midterm. And moreover, Hubert Humphrey, the Democratic nominee, gets, what was it, 35, roughly 34 point something percent of the vote in the next presidential election. George Wallace and Richard Nixon carve up something like 65% of the vote. The electoral test, Medicare was a disaster, and so was the Voting Rights Act. So was the other reforms of the period, like the Secondary School Education Act. Are there any historians who'd agree with that judgment? I don't think so. Medicare is one of the great acts in American history, not just in any one administration or any one generation, and the Voting Rights Act, ditto. So this is actually a media test, a sort of popular test, but it's not really the test historians will take seriously. For Barack Obama, the legacy lies in what just passed and its implications. And as you said, Chris, its unanticipated consequence, its unanticipated consequences, and its, as I said, its secondary and tertiary effects on politics down the line. And I don't think the midterms are going to touch that, just like the midterms didn't really touch the Medicare legacy.
Interesting. Jim Marone, can't thank you enough. This is completely fascinating and almost completely different from anything I've heard anyplace else.
Well, I'll say no radio show ever lets you wander over between empire and healthcare and the narrative of America. This has been really fun, a real treat for me, Chris.
Jim Marone, thank you. Ben Mandelkern produced and edited our conversation with James Marone, professor of political science at Brown University. His book last year on healthcare politics was The Heart of Power. Feedback your own sense of the big narrative, the new narrative of the Obama presidency, and link back to Jim Marone's forecast 6 months ago at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the conversation.